direction. I didn't miss that Kimmelin and I had come in the back way, the opposite direction of the mess hall. So was she sick or not? After the two girls left, FM's head, her short hair clipped back with a glittering beret, popped out of one of the doors. She gestured with an urgent wave. Kimmelin dashed down the hall to her and I followed, ducking into their room. FM slammed the door, then grinned. Their small room was as I remembered it, though one of the beds had been removed when Morningtide died. That left a bunk on the left wall and a single bed by the right. A pile of blankets lay lumped between them, and the dresser held two trays of food, steaming soup in bowls with algae tofu and slices of thick bread. Real bread. With real imitation butter. My mouth started watering. "We asked for extra," Kimmelin said, "but they sent soup because they think we're sick. Still, you can't ask for more when you already have it, as the saint said." "They removed the extra bed," FM said, "so we piled some blankets on the floor. The trick is going to be using the lavatories, but we'll run interference for you." It finally sank in. They'd pretended to be sick, so they could order food into the room and share it. They'd snuck me to the room and made a bed for me. Stars. Gratitude surged up inside me. I was going to cry. Warriors did not cry.
"Oh, you look angry," Kimmelin said. "Don't be angry. We're not implying you're too weak to walk to your cave. We just thought, you know."
"It would be nice to take a break," FM said. "Even a great warrior can take the occasional break. Right, Spin?" I nodded, not trusting myself to speak.
"Great," Kimmelin said. "Let's dig in. Subterfuge makes me famished."
Chapter 28. That soup tasted better than the blood of my enemies. Considering I'd never actually tasted the blood of my enemies, perhaps that didn't do justice to the soup. It tasted better than soup should. It tasted of laughter and love and appreciation. The warmth of it glowed inside me like ignited rocket fuel. I snuggled in the blankets, holding the big bowl in my lap, while Kimmelin and FM chatted. I fought down the tears. I would not cry. But the soup tasted of home, somehow.
"I told you the costume would make her come with me," Kimmelin was saying as she sat on her bed cross-legged. "Black is the color of intrigue."
"You're insane," FM said, wagging her spoon. "You're lucky nobody saw you. Defiants are all too eager to look for a reason to be offended."
"You're defiant too, FM," I said. "You were born here, like the rest of us. You're a citizen of the United Defiant Caverns. Why do you keep pretending you're something different?"
FM grinned in an eager way. It seemed that she liked that sort of question.
"Being a defiant," she said, "isn't just about our nationality. It's always expressed as a mindset. A true defiant will think this way, or to be defiant, you need to never back down, things like that. So, by their own logic, I can undefiant myself through personal choices."
"And you want to?" I said, cocking my head.
Kimmelin handed me another slice of bread.
"She thinks you all might be a touch bellicose."
"There's that word again," I said. "Who talks like that?"
"People who are erudite," Kimmelin said, sipping her soup.
"I refuse to be trapped by bonds of autocracy and nationalism," FM said. "To survive, our people have become necessarily hardened. But alongside it, we have enslaved ourselves. Most people never question and doggedly go through the motions of an obedient life. Others have increased aggression to the point that it's hard to have natural feelings."
"I have natural feelings," I said, "and I'll fight anyone who says otherwise."
FM eyed me. "I'd insist on swords at dawn," I said, eating the bread.
but I'll probably be too full of bread to get up. Is this seriously what you all get to eat every day?
Well, what do you eat, dear?
Kimmelin said. Rats, I said. And mushrooms.
Every day?
I used to put pepper on the rats, but I ran out. The two of them shared a look.
It's an embarrassment to the DDF, what the Admiral has done to you, FM said. But it's a natural outgrowth of the totalitarian need for absolute power over those who resist her. The very example of the hypocrisy of the system. Defiance is not defiant to them unless it doesn't actually defy anything.
I shot a glance at Kimmelin, who shrugged.
She's extremely passionate about this. We are propping up a government that has overreached its bounds in the name of public safety, FM said. The people must speak up and rise against the upper class who holds them enslaved.
Upper class like you? I asked. FM looked down at her soup, then sighed.
I'd go to the disputer meetings, and my parents would just pat me on the head and explain to everyone else that I was going through a counterculture phase. Then they signed me up for flight school and, well, I mean, I get to fly.
I nodded. That part I understood.
I figure, if I become a famous pilot, I can speak for the little guys, you know? I'm more likely to be able to change things here than down in the deep caverns, wearing ball gowns and sitting primly next to my sisters. Right? Don't you think?
Sure, I said. That makes perfect sense. Right, Quirk?
I keep telling her that, Kimmelin said to me. But I think it will mean more from you.
Why me? I asked. FM, didn't you say people like me have unnatural emotions?
Yes, but you can't help being a product of your environment, FM said. It's not your fault you're a bloodthirsty ball of aggression and destruction.
I am? I perked up. Like, that's how you see me?
She nodded.
Awesome. The door to the little room suddenly opened, and by instinct I hefted the bowl, figuring that the still warm soup might make a good diversion if flung in someone's face.
Hurl slipped in, her lean form silhouetted by the hallway's light.
Scud. I hadn't even thought about her. The other two had brought me in while she was away at dinner. Had they cleared this little infraction with her? She met my eyes, then hurriedly shut the door.
I brought desserts, she said, lifting a small bundle wrapped in a napkin.
Jerkface caught me taking them as he stopped by. I think he just does that to glare at us before he goes off to be with more important people for dinner.
What did you tell him? Kimmelin said.
I said I wanted a midnight snack. Hopefully he doesn't suspect anything. The hallway looked clear. No MPs or anything. I think we're good.
She unwrapped the napkin, revealing some chocolate cake that was only mildly squashed by the transportation. I watched her, thoughtful, as she gave us each a piece, then flopped onto her bed, stuffing the last chunk into her mouth in one go. This was a girl who had barely spoken to me over the last few weeks. Now she brought me cake? I was certainly relieved that she wasn't going to turn me in, but I didn't know what to make of her otherwise. I settled back down in my blankets, then tried the cake. It was so, so much better than rat. I couldn't help but let out a little groan of delight, at which Kimmelin grinned. She sat on the side of Hurl's bed, which hadn't been made in the morning. Kimmelin's bed was the neatly made top bunk above, with the immaculate corners and the frilled pillowcase. FM's was on the other side, with the stack of books on the shelf near the headboard.
So, I said, licking my fingers.
What do you guys do all night?
Sleep? Hurl asked.
For 12 hours?
Well, there's PT, FM said. We do laps in the pool usually, though Hurl prefers the weights. And target practice with sidearms, or extra time in the centrifuge.
I still haven't thrown up in that, Hurl said, which is, in my opinion, completely inappropriate.
Hurl taught us wall ball, Kimmelin said. It's fun to watch her play the boys. They always take it as an invigorating challenge. By which she means it's satisfying to watch Ned lose, FM said. He seems so befuddled every time. She trailed off, perhaps realizing that they'd never get to see him play again. My stomach twisted. Swimming. Target practice. Sports. I'd known what I was missing, but hearing it like that...
We won't be expected to do any of that tonight, Kimmelin said, since we're sick. It will be fun, Spin! We can stay up all night talking.
About what? I asked.
Normal things, FM said, shrugging.
What was normal?
Like, guys?
Stars, no, Hurl said, sitting up and pulling something off her headboard. She held up a sketchbook filled with little drawings of ships going through patterns.
Flight strategies.
Pearl keeps trying to name new moves after herself, FM noted. But we figure the Pearl maneuver really ought to have several loops in it or something. Like the one on page 15.
I hate loops, Pearl said. We should call that the quirk maneuver. It's flowery.
Don't be silly, Kimmelin said. I'd somehow end up crashing into myself if I had to do that many loops.
A quirk maneuver would involve complimenting the enemy while you shoot them, FM said, grinning.
Oh, you make lovely sparks when you die. You should feel very proud of yourself. Good job.
My tension bled away as the girls showed off the maneuvers they'd designed. The names were consistently terrible. But the chatter was fun, engaging, and, well, just so very welcome. I took a turn sketching an obscenely complex maneuver into the book, something between an Alstrom loop and a double switchback with a sidewind.
Crazy thing is, FM said, she could probably pull that off.
Yeah, Kimmelin said, maybe we could rename Taken Off the quirk maneuver. That's the only thing I can manage consistently.
You're not nearly as bad as that, Hurl said to her.
I'm the worst pilot in the flat.
And the best shot.
Which matters zero if I die before I can fire back.
I grunted, hand still on Hurl's notebook. I turned to another page. Quirk is a great sniper. And Hurl, you're excellent at chasing down Krell ships. FM, you're excellent at dodging.
I can barely hit the broadside of a mountain, though, FM said. I guess if you somehow mashed us all together, you'd have one good pilot.
Couldn't we try something like that? I said, sketching.
Cobb says that the Krell are always on the lookout for pilots who distinguish themselves. He says that if they find someone they think might be flight leader, they concentrate all fire on that person.
Yeah? Hurl said, sitting up on her bed.
What are you saying?
Well, if they really are machines... Maybe they've got this mandate to hunt down our leaders. Maybe it's stuck in their machine brains, to the point that they follow that command to ridiculous ends.
That seems like a stretch, FM said.
I glanced at my pack and the portable radio on the side. The light was flashing. Embot had tried to call me, probably with another request for mushrooms.
Look, I said, returning to my sketch.
What if we encouraged the Krell to focus on specific members of our flight? If they concentrated fire on FM, who is best at dodging, they might leave the others alone. Quirk could set up and pick them off. Pearl could hang back and then chase after any who decided to try to bring down our gunner.
The others leaned in close.
Pearl nodded, though FM shook her head.
I'm not sure I could survive that spin. I would end up with dozens of tails. I'd be shot down for sure.
But maybe you could manage it.
You're our best pilot, Quirk agreed. And you're not frightened of anything.
My pen stilled, and I looked at the half-drawn flight plan, with Quirk's ship sitting at the perimeter sniping down Krell. I'd drawn a dozen ships chasing after a single pilot.
What would it feel like to be in the seat? Knowing you had heat from a dozen enemies.
Immediately, my daydreaming took over, imagining it as an incredible, dramatic fight. Explosions and excitement and glory. But now there was another voice inside me. A quiet, solemn one that whispered, That's not reality, Spin. In reality, you'd be terrified. I licked my lips. I don't know if I could do it either. I force it out. I get scared sometimes. FM frowned. So some of what I say, it's kind of bravado. In reality, I'm not that confident.
You mean you're human?
Kimmelin said.
Blessed stars, who would have thought?
You sound like you're making some big confession, FM agreed.
Guys, I have emotions. They're terrible.
I blushed. It's a big deal for me. I spent my childhood dreaming of the days when I could fly and fight. Now that I'm here and I've lost friends, it hurts. I'm weaker than I thought I was.
If that makes you weak, FM said, I must be useless.
Yeah, Kimmelin said. You're not crazy, Spin. You're a person.
Albeit, FM added, one who has been thoroughly indoctrinated by a soulless system designed only to spit out willing, jingoistic, obedient thralls. No offense.
I couldn't help noticing that Hurl had grown quiet at this conversation. She was lying back on her bed and looking at the bunk above.
You can admit these things to us, Quark said. It's all right. We're a team.
She leaned in toward FM and me.
Since we're being honest here, can I tell you something? Truth is, I make up most of those quotes I say.
I blinked. Really? Like, the saint never said all those things?
No,
Kimmelin said in a conspiratorial whisper.
I came up with them myself. I simply don't admit it because I don't want to appear too wise. It's unseemly.
My entire world is shaken right now, Quirk, FM said. I feel like you just told me Up is really down, or that Hurl's breath smells great.
Hey, Hurl said. See if I get you cake again.
This is serious, I said to the other two. I get scared. I might secretly be a coward. FM and Kimmelin blew it off. They reassured me and talked about how they felt. FM still thought she was a hypocrite for wanting to bring down the DDF while also wanting to fly with it. Kimmelin had the soul of a smart aleck, but the upbringing of a polite society girl. I appreciated their kindness, but it occurred to me that the counterculture disputer and the girl from Bountiful might not be the best people to understand how important it was that I not be afraid. So I let the conversation slide in other directions. We talked far into the night, and it was wonderful. Sincere and friendly. But as the night grew long, I found myself strangely anxious. In some ways, this was one of the best days of my life. But it also reaffirmed what I'd always feared. That the others were bonding without me. My mind scrambled, even as I grinned at something Kimmelin said. Was there a way to extend this? How often could the girls claim to be sick? When could I come back? Eventually, biology began to make its demands, so Quirk and FM went to scout out the restroom. That left me with Hurl, who had been dozing off. I didn't want to wake her, so I waited by the door.
I know how you feel, Hurl suddenly said.
I almost jumped out of my skin. You're awake? She nodded. She didn't even seem drowsy, though I swore I'd heard her snoring softly earlier.
Fear doesn't make us cowards, though. Does it?
Hurl asked. I don't know, I said, walking over to her bed. I wish I could just smother it. Hurl nodded again. Thank you, I said, for letting the other two plan this night for me. I know spending time with me wouldn't have been your first choice.
I saw what you did for Ned, she said. I watched you fly in after him, right into the depths of that chunk of debris.
I couldn't let him go alone.
Yeah.
She hesitated.
My mother told stories of your father, you know. When she saw me back down on the playground, or flinch from a ball during practice. She told me about the pilot who claimed to be brave, but was a coward inside. "Don't you dare sully the name of the Defiant people," she'd say to me. "Don't you dare become a chaser." I winced. "But we don't have to be like that," Hurl continued. That's what I realized. A little fear, a little history. Those things don't mean anything. Only what we do means anything. She looked toward me. "I'm sorry for how I treated you. It was just a shock when I found out. But you're not him, and I'm not either, regardless of what I feel sometimes." "My father wasn't a coward, Hurl," I said. "The DDF lies about him." She didn't look like she believed me, but she nodded anyway. Then she sat up, holding out her fist. "Not cowards. No backing down. Brave until the end, right, Spin? A pact." I met her fist with mine. Brave to the end. Chapter 29. I woke up, snuggled into too many blankets, and reached out to feel the side of M-Bot's cockpit, but my hand slapped the side of a bed frame. Right. What time was it? I tapped my light line to glance at its clock, raising a soft glow in the room. Just before 5 in the morning. 2 hours until we had to be ready for class. I should have been exhausted, as we'd stayed up talking until after 1. Strangely, I felt wide awake. Perhaps my brain knew that if I wanted to use the facilities and get cleansed today, I'd need to do it now, while everyone else in the building was sleeping. In fact, it was probably best if I snuck out and was seen walking back to the building before class. I climbed out of my nest and stretched, then grabbed my backpack. I tried to be as quiet as possible, though I probably shouldn't have worried. If the others could sleep through Hurl's snoring, my pack scraping the floor wouldn't disturb them. I slipped open the door, then turned and looked at the 3 sleeping girls. "Thank you," I whispered. Right then, I decided I wouldn't let them do this again. It was too dangerous. I didn't want to get them on the Admiral's bad side. This had been wondrous. Even if it left me knowing for sure what I was missing. Even if I felt sick to have to walk away. Even if I twisted inside, I wouldn't have traded this night for anything. My only taste of what it was like to be part of a real flight of pilots. That thought loomed in my mind as I walked to the bathroom and cleansed. Afterward, looking in the bathroom mirror, I smoothed back my wet hair. In all the stories, the heroes had stark black, golden, or red hair, something dramatic, not dirty brown. I sighed, threw my pack on my shoulder, and slipped out into the empty hallway. As I walked to the exit, a light down a corridor caught my attention. I knew that room. It was our classroom. Who would be there at this hour? My curiosity overcame my common sense. I snuck over to peek in through the window in the door and saw Jorgen's cockpit engaged, the hologram up and running. What was he doing here at 0530? Getting in a little extra practice? Cobb's hologram in the center of the room projected a miniature version of the training battlefield, so I could watch Jorgen's ship light lance around a hovering piece of debris, then fire on a Krell. Something about that fight looked familiar. Yes, it was the one where Bim and Morningtide had died. I'd seen Cobb watching the same recording. Morningtide's ship went down in flames, and I winced. Though just before she hit, the hologram froze, then restarted. I watched again, picking out Jorgen's ship as he flew from the other side of the battlefield, dodging debris, making for the ship that would destroy Morningtide. He fired off his IMP, but even as he took down the enemy shield, the Krell blasted Morningtide's ship and sent her spinning downward. The hologram restarted, and Jorgen tried again, going a different direction this time. He's trying to figure out if he could have saved them, I realized. When Morningtide went down this 3rd time, the hologram continued, but Jorgen heaved himself out of his seat. He ripped off his helmet and slammed it against the wall with a loud bang. I flinched and almost bolted, worried the noise might draw attention. But seeing Jorgen, normally so tall and imperious, slumped against the wall, I couldn't walk away.
He looked so vulnerable, so human. Losing Bim and Morning Tide had been hard on me. I'd never thought about how it had been for their flight leader, the one who was supposed to keep us all out of trouble. Jorgen dropped his helmet. He turned away from the wall, then froze. Scud. He'd seen me. I ducked away and was out the exit of the building before he could catch up, but what now? Suddenly, a gaping hole appeared in our little subterfuge. What if the guards at the gate told the Admiral that I'd never left last night? Surely they didn't report to the Admiral every day about every person who went in and out of the base, right? But if I left now, then came right back in, they'd definitely notice something was odd. So, instead of going to the gate, I aimlessly walked the pathways of the base between buildings. It was dark out, the skylights dim, and the pathways mostly empty. In fact, I passed more statues than I did people. Busts of the first citizens, looking toward the sky, lined this part of the walkway. A too cold gust of wind blew across me, shaking the branches of a nearby tree. In the dim light, the statues were haunting figures, their stone eyes lost in shadow. The air smelled of smoke from the nearby launch pads, a pungent scent. A fighter must have returned to base on fire recently. I sighed and sat down on a bench along the walkway, dropping my pack next to me. I felt melancholy, perhaps a little wistful. The call light on the radio was still blinking. Maybe talking to Embot would kick me out of my funk. I switched it into receiving mode. "Hey, Embot."
"I'm outraged," Embot said. "This is an insult beyond insults. I cannot express with words my indignation, but my built-in thesaurus says that I am insulted, affronted, maltreated, desecrated, injured, ravaged, persecuted, and or possibly molested."
"Sorry. I didn't mean to turn you off."
"Turn me off?
I've had the radio off all night. Isn't that what you're angry about?"
"Oh, that's just normal human forgetfulness. But don't you remember? I wrote a subroutine to express that I'm mad at you."
I frowned, trying to remember what the ship was talking about.
"You said I was a Krell," he said. "I got mad. It was kind of a big deal."
"Right. Sorry."
"Apology accepted," Embot answered.
He sounded pleased with himself.
"I projected a nice sense of outrage, don't you think?"
"It was splendid."
"I thought so."
I sat for a time, silent. Something about last night. It left me feeling reflective, quiet. She really isn't ever going to let me fly, I thought, smelling the smoke from the launch pad fire. I can graduate, but it will be meaningless.
"You're right, though," Embot noted. "I might be a Krell."
"What?" I said, practically smacking myself with the radio as I raised it to my lips.
"I mean, my data banks have mostly been lost," Embot said. "There's no saying what was in there."
"Then why did you get so angry at me for suggesting you might be a Krell?"
"It seemed the correct thing to do. I'm supposed to simulate having a personality. What person would let themselves be slandered like that? Even if it was a completely logical assumption, and you are making a perfectly valid threat assessment by wondering about it."
"I really don't know what to make of you, Embot."
"I don't either. Sometimes, my subroutines engage with responses before my main personality simulator has time to rein them in. It's very confusing. In a perfectly logical machine way, not at all irrational like human emotions."
"Sure."
"You are using sarcasm. Be careful, or I'll engage my outrage routine again. But if it helps, I don't think the Krell are AIs, regardless of what your DDF thinkers have determined."
"Really? Why do you think that?"
"I've analyzed their flight patterns, and yours, by the way. I might have some pointers to help you improve. It seems I have entire subroutines dedicated to that kind of analysis. Anyway, I don't think all of the Krell are AIs, though some might be. My analysis finds that most of their patterns are individual, not complying with easily determined logical routines. At the same time, they are reckless, which is curious. I suspect they are drones of some sort, though I will say that Cobb is right. This planet exerts some interference on communications. I appear to have boosting technology that helps me pierce the interference.
Well, you are a stealth ship. Advanced communications technology probably helped with your missions.
Yes, my holographic projectors, active camouflage, and sonar avoidance are probably there for the same reason.
I didn't even know you could do most of those things. Camouflage? Holograms?
My settings say I had these systems engaged on standby mode, creating an illusion of rubble over my ship and preventing scans from detecting my cavern, until recently when my backup power ran out. I'd give you the exact time to the nanosecond, but humans generally hate that kind of precision, as it makes me seem calculating and alien.
Well, that probably explains why nobody found you all those years.
I tapped the radio, thoughtful. Regardless, Embot said. I hope I'm not a Krell. That would be super embarrassing.
You're no Krell, I said, and realized I meant it. I'd worried earlier, but now... I just couldn't explain why, but I knew he wasn't.
Maybe, he said. I'll admit I'm... worried that I might be something evil like that, and not know it.
If you were a Krell... why would you have human living space and plugs that work with ours?
I could have been built to infiltrate human society by imitating one of your ships, he said. Or actually, what if the Krell are all rogue AIs, originally created by humans? That would explain why I had your writing on me. Or maybe I...
You're not a Krell, I said. I can feel it.
That's probably some irrational human confirmation bias speaking, he noted. But my subroutine that can simulate appreciation is appreciative.
I nodded.
That's kind of what it does, he added. Appreciate things.
I would never have figured.
It can appreciate something at a million times per second, so you could say your comment is likely the single most appreciated thing you've ever done.
I'd appreciate you shutting up about how great you are once in a while, I said. But I smiled and stuck the radio onto my backpack.
I'm not appreciating that comment, he noted softly. Just so you know.
I flipped the radio off, then stood up and stretched. A few First Citizen busts seemed to glare at me from nearby, including a younger Cobb. How strange to look at an image of him now that I knew him so well. He shouldn't look young. Hadn't he been born a crusty 50-year-old man? I shouldered my pack and wandered back toward the flight school building. An MP stood right outside the main entrance. I stopped in place. Then, worried, I approached.
Cadet Nightshade? The MP asked. Call sign Spin.
My heart sank.
Admiral Ironsides would like to speak with you.
I nodded. The MP led me to the building where I'd met Jorgen and the Admiral that once. As we neared, my sense of resignation grew. Somehow I'd known this was coming. Staying with the girls last night had been a bad idea, but this wasn't about one little infraction. It seemed to me, as I stepped into the building, that a confrontation had been growing inevitable. I deserved this for what I'd done to Jorgen, twice over. More telling, the Admiral was the most powerful person in the DDF, while I was the daughter of a coward. In some ways, it was remarkable she hadn't found a way to kick me out before this. It was time for it to end. I was a fighter, yes, but a good fighter knew when a battle was unwinnable. The MP deposited me inside the Admiral's shockingly messy office. Ironsides was drinking coffee at her desk, looking over some report, her back to me.
Close the door, she said.
I obeyed.
There's a note here on the security reports at the gate. You didn't leave last night. Have you made a hidey hole in one of the maintenance closets or something?
Yes, I said, relieved that at least she didn't know the others had helped me.
Have you eaten mess hall food, stolen by your own hand, or smuggled out for you by one of your flightmates?
I hesitated. Yes. The Admiral sipped her coffee, still not looking toward me. I stared at her back,
her silvery hair, bracing myself for the words. You're out.
Don't you think it's time to stop this farce? She said, turning a page. Drop out now. I'll let you keep your cadet's pin.
I frowned. Why ask? Why not just say the words? She had the power, now that I'd broken her rules, didn't she?
Ironsides turned her chair, fixing me with a cold stare.
Nothing to say, cadet?
Why do you care so much? I asked. I'm only one girl. I'm no threat to you.
The admiral set down her coffee, then stood. She straightened her crisp white uniform jacket, then stepped up to me. Like most people, she towered over me.
You think this is about my pride, girl? Ironsides asked.
If I let you continue in the DDF, you'll get good people killed when you inevitably run.
So I offer again. Walk away with the pin.
In the city below, it should be enough to secure you any number of jobs, many quite lucrative.
She stared at me hard, and suddenly it made sense. She couldn't kick me out. Not because she lacked the power, but because she needed me to prove that she was right. She needed me to drop out, give up, because that was what a coward would do. Her rules weren't about tricking me into an infraction. They were about making my life terrible so that I backed down. If she kicked me out, I could continue the narrative. I could claim my family had been wronged. I could scream about my father's innocence. My treatment would only support my victimhood. Not being able to sleep in the cadet quarters? No food during my training? That would look terrible. But if I walked away, she won. It was the only way she won. In that moment, I was more powerful than the very admiral in command of the Defiant Defense Force. So I saluted.
Can I return to my classes now, sir?
A blush rose to her cheeks.
You're a coward. From a family of cowards.
I held the salute.
I could destroy you. See you impoverished. You don't want me as an enemy. Reject my kind offer now, and you will never have another chance at it.
I held the salute.
Bah,
the admiral said, turning from me and sitting down hard. She grabbed her coffee and drank, as if I weren't there. I took it as a dismissal. I turned and let myself out, and the MP, still standing outside the door, let me go. Nobody came for me as I walked to the classroom. I went straight to my cockpit and sat down, then greeted the others as they arrived. When Cobb hobbled in, I realized I was excited for class. It felt as if I'd maybe finally escaped the shadow that had been hovering over me since Bim and Morningtide had died. The girls and their kindness were part of that, but my conversation with Ironsides was a bigger part. She'd given me what I needed to keep fighting. She'd invigorated me. In a strange way, she'd brought me back to life. I would fight. I would find the answers to what had really happened to my father. And Ironsides would regret forcing me to do both. Part 4. Interlude. Admiral Judy Ironsides Ivins always watched the battle replays. She used the main control room, which had a large holographic projector in the center of the circular floor. She preferred to stand in its center, light shining up across her, the rest of the room dark. She watched them fight. She watched them die. She forced herself to listen to the audio, if there was any, of each pilot's last words. She tried to read the enemy's goals in the pattern of red and blue ships. Red for the DDF, blue for the Krell. It had been years since she'd been a pilot. Yet as she stood with headphones on, ships swirling around her, the feel of it returned to her. The hum of the booster, the rush of a banking ship, the rattle of destructor fire, the pulse of the battlefield. Some days, she entertained fancies of climbing into a ship and joining the fray again. Then she banished those idiot dreams.
The DDF was too low on ships to waste one on an old woman with shriveled reaction times. Fragmented tales and some old print history books spoke of great generals who took up a weapon and joined their soldiers on the front lines. Judy, however, knew she was no Julius Caesar. She was barely a Nero. Still, Judy Ivins was dangerous in other ways. She watched the battle spin and fly beneath the shadow of the slowly dropping shipyard. The Krell had committed almost 60 ships to this flight, two-thirds of their maximum, a major investment for them. It was clear they knew that if that wreckage had fallen into DDF hands intact, it would have been a huge boon. There had been hundreds of acclivity rings on that massive ship station. Now, salvage reported that fewer than a dozen so far were recoverable, and Judy had lost 14 ships in the engagement. She saw, in their deaths, her own faults. She hadn't been willing to truly commit. If she'd raised all of their reserve ships and pilots, then thrown them at the battle, she might have earned hundreds of acclivity rings. Instead, she'd wavered, worried about a trap, until it was too late. That was what she lacked, compared to people like Caesar of old. She needed to be willing to commit everything. Reculfer, her aide, stepped up to her with a clipboard full of notes. Judy rewound the battlefield, highlighting a specific pilot, the cadet who had given her so much trouble. Ships exploded and pilots died. Judy wouldn't let herself feel for the deaths. She couldn't let herself feel for them. As long as they had more pilots than acclivity rings, and they did, slightly, then personnel was the more disposable of the two resources. Finally, Judy took off her headphones.
"She flies well," Reculfer said.
"Too well?" Judy asked. Reculfer flipped through papers on his clipboard.
"Newest data is in from her helmet sensors. It hasn't been encouraging during her training. Almost no anomalies. But that fight you're watching, the battle at the falling shipyard, well..."
He turned the clipboard toward her, showing a set of readings that were literally off the chart.
"The Rytellum section of her brain," Reculfer said, "went crazy with activity when she was around the Krell. Dr. Halbeth is certain this is proof of the defect, though Iglum is less certain. He cites the lack of evidence except for this one engagement."
Judy grunted, watching the coward's ship loop around, then fly into the very bowels of the falling shipyard.
"Halbeth recommends immediately removing the girl from duty," Reculfer noted. "But Dr. Thior, well, she is going to be trouble, as you would guess."
Thior, who was unfortunately head of Alta Base Medical, didn't believe that the defect was real. Even the history of the thing was controversial. Reports of it dated back to the Defiant itself, and the mutiny on board the flagship that had ended with the fleet crashing here on Detritus. Few people knew about the mutiny, and fewer still the fact that a defect in some of the crew had been the cause. These things weren't clear even to Judy. But some of the most important and most merited families in the lower caverns traced their lineage to the mutineers. Those families fought against acknowledging the defect and wanted to keep rumors of it secret. But they hadn't seen what it could do to someone. Judy had, firsthand.
"Who is supporting Thior this time?" Judy asked.
Reculfer flipped a few pages, then displayed the latest round of letters from prominent party members. At their head was a letter from NAL Algernon Waite, whose son Jorgen was in the coward's flight. Jorgen had spoken highly of the girl on repeated occasions, so now came the questions.
"Wouldn't it be for the best to hold this girl up as a sign of true defiant redemption? A symbol of how any person, regardless of heritage, could return to the fold and provide service to the state?"
"Damn it," Judy thought, pausing the hologram as the coward hit her overburn in a near disastrous attempt to escape.
"How much proof is Algernon going to require?" "Orders, sir?" Reculfer asked. "Tell Dr. Halbeth to write a condemnation of Thior's explanations. Then see if Dr. Iglum can be persuaded to offer strong support of the defect's existence, particularly in this girl.
Tell her I'd consider it a personal favor
if she could strengthen her stand.
As you wish, sir.
Reculfer retreated, and Judy watched the rest of the battle, remembering a similar fight long ago. Thyor and the others could call the defect superstition. They could say that what had happened with Chaser was coincidence. But they hadn't been there. And Judy was going to make damn sure nothing like that ever happened again. One way or another. Chapter 30. So I'm pretty sure she won't ever kick me out, I said, working with Rig to apply new sealant to M-Bot's wing.
You can infer more from a look than anyone I know, Rig said. Just because she didn't kick you out this time doesn't mean she won't in the future.
She won't, I said. She won't, Doomslug said with a fluting trill, imitating the inflection of my voice from her perch on a nearby rock. Rig had done an amazing job with M-Bot's broken wing. Together, we'd torn off the bent metal, then recovered the usable parts. Then somehow, Rig had persuaded his new supervisors to let him practice on one of the manufactories. With new parts in hand, we'd been able to repair the entire wing. The next week had been spent removing the old layer of sealant. Today, we were going over the entire hull with a new coat. Now that I'd entered my third month of training, we'd earned occasional R&R, so today, our flight had only a half day of classes. I'd come back early and had met Rig to work on the ship. Rig painted the sealant on with a small spray device, and I followed behind with a two-handed machine that looked kind of like a big flashlight. The blue light from it made the sealant firm up and solidify. The process, though slow and grueling, filled in scratches and dents on M-Bot's hull. The slick, air-resistant sealant also filled in and smoothed out seams, leaving behind a sleek, shiny surface. We'd chosen black, to match his old color. I still can't believe they let you borrow all this stuff, I said, as I slowly positioned the light behind where Rig was spraying.
After how enthused they were by my atmospheric scoop designs, Rig said. They seemed ready to promote me to head of the department on the spot. Nobody even batted an eye when I asked if I could bring this stuff home to disassemble it and see how it works. They think I'm some kind of prodigy with eclectic methods.
You're not still embarrassed, are you? I said. Rig, this technology could single-handedly save the entire DDF.
I know, he said. I just wish, you know, that I really were a prodigy.
I set the light on the ground to give my arms a break. Seriously, Rig? I waved toward M-Bot's wing, which now glistened with a new black sealant job.
You're telling me that fixing a technologically advanced starship's wing, practically on your own, in the middle of an uninhabited cave with minimal equipment, isn't the work of a prodigy?
Rig stepped back, raising his goggles and inspecting the wing. Then he grinned.
It does look pretty good, doesn't it? And it will be even better when that last part is sealed, eh?
He hefted the spray. I sighed, stretching, but picked the lighting device back up. I followed behind as he started spraying the last section of the hull, near the front.
So, you going to spend more nights in the bunks now?
He asked as we worked. No, I can't risk getting the others involved. This is between me and Ironsides.
I still think you're reading too much into what she said.
I narrowed my eyes. Ironsides is a warrior. She knows that to win this fight, she can't just defeat me. She needs to demoralize me. She needs to be able to say I was a coward, like the lies she tells about my father. Rig continued to work in silence for a few minutes, and I thought he was going to let the argument pass. He sprayed a careful line of sealant under the part of the hull that locked into the cockpit. Then, though, he said in a more subdued tone,
"That's great, Svensa. But have you ever paused to wonder what you'll do if you're wrong?"
I shrugged.
"If I'm wrong, she'll kick me out. Nothing I can do about that. I wasn't talking about the Admiral. I meant your father, Svensa. What if... you know, what if he did retreat?
My father wasn't a coward,
But my father was not a coward. Rig glanced away from his work and met my eyes. The glare I gave back would have been enough to silence most people, but he held my gaze.
What about me?
He asked. Am I a coward, Spencer? My fury sputtered, then died. He looked back to his spraying.
You say if you drop out, it will prove you're a coward. Well, I dropped out, so I'm a coward. Basically, the worst thing you could imagine.
Rig, it's different.
Is Cobb a coward? He ejected, you know. He got shot down and ejected. Would you call him a coward to his face?
Rig finished covering the last metallic section with black sealant, then stepped back. He shook his head and looked at me.
Spin, maybe you're right. Maybe there's some big conspiracy that has pinned a great betrayal on your father. Or maybe, you know, he just got scared. Maybe he was human and acted like humans sometimes do. Maybe the problem is that everyone has made such a big deal of it.
I don't have to listen to this, I said, setting down the ceiling light. I stomped off, though the only place I could stomp to was the other side of the cavern.
Spin, you can't walk off and ignore me, Rig said from behind. This cavern is like 20 meters across.
I sat down. Doomslug trilled beside me, imitating my huff of annoyance. Like usual, I hadn't caught sight of her moving over. The way she snuck about only when nobody was watching her was uncanny. From the sounds of it, Rig picked up the light and sealed the last section himself. I sat with my back to him as he worked.
Fume if you want, he noted. Snap at me if you want. But at least think about it. You seem like you really want to defy the Admiral and the DDF. Maybe you should consider not allowing them to define victory or failure for you.
I snorted. You sound like FM.
So she's smart and cute.
I twisted to look back. FM? Cute?
She has nice eyes.
I gaped at him.
What?
He said, blushing as he worked. You didn't stutter or fumble or anything, I said.
What did you do with Raj, you Krell monster?
What?
Embot said, lights on his wings flashing on.
Raj is a Krell?
Sarcasm,
the two of us said in unison. Rig finished the sealing, then set the device down. He looked over at me.
You will not tell her I said those things. She probably doesn't even remember who I am.
He hesitated.
Does she?
Of course she does, I lied. Rig smiled again. He looked so different now, so confident. What had happened to him these last 2 months? He found something he loves, I realized, as he put his hands on his hips and smiled at Embot's new finish. And really, the ship did look incredible. All our lives, Rig and I had dreamed of the DDF. But what had he said when he dropped out? That's your dream. I was just along for the ride. Deciding not to be a pilot had been the right choice for him. I'd known that, but had I known it, really? I stood up, then walked over and put an arm around him. You're no coward, I said. I'm an idiot if I made you feel like you were. And this, what you've done here, this is better than pretty good.
Rig, this is scudding incredible.
His smile widened.
Well, we won't know for certain on that count until you take the ship into the air.
He checked his watch.
I should have time enough to watch you take off.
Take off? I gaped. You mean he's ready to fly? He's fixed?
Embot, Rig called. Basic status update.
Acclivity ring, functional. Life support and pilot care facilities, functional. Maneuvering and flight controls, functional. Shield, functional. Light lance, functional.
Incredible, I said. With the acclivity ring and the maneuvering thrusters, I could move up into the air and get around a little, though not at any reasonable speed.
We still need a booster, Rig said, and new guns.
I'm not going to risk trying to fabricate either of those, even with my newfound status in the engineering department.
Boosters, non-functional,
Embot added.
Destructors, non-functional. Cytonic hyperdrive, non-functional.
I also have no idea how you'll get out of here, Rig said, looking up at the ceiling. How did you even get in, Embot?
Likely I used a cytonic hyperjump to teleport,
Embot said.
I can't tell you how it worked. Only that this device allowed faster-than-light travel through the galaxy.
I perked up. Can we fix that?
Best I can tell, Rig said. It's not broken. It's missing. Embot's diagnostics indicate where this cytonic hyperdrive should be, and it's an empty box with a display panel on one end. Someone must have taken the mechanism, whatever it was.
Huh. Maybe the old pilot had taken it?
Rig flipped through his notebook, then waved for me to look over his shoulder.
I'm pretty certain I fixed the maneuvering thrusters on that broken wing, he said, pointing at a schematic. But be sure he leaves diagnostics on to record it all, so I can check to make sure everything is in order.
He flipped to the next page.
And once we know he's flying right, I want to disassemble his shield igniter and see if I can figure out why it can apparently, by his specs, take 3 times the punishment of a standard DDF shield.
I grinned. That ought to make you popular with the engineering and design teams.
Yeah, unless they start to get suspicious.
Rig hesitated, then spoke more softly.
I did eventually try and look at his AI mechanism, but he wouldn't let me open the housing. He even threatened to electrify it. He says that device, along with some other systems, is classified. Stealth systems, communication systems, some very important stuff.
Spin, to really help the DDF, we would need to let an expert in here to disassemble and analyze the ship. I can only do so much.
I felt something wrench inside me, like gears locking up from lack of grease. I glanced back at Embot.
He has warned, Rig said, that if we reveal him, he will attempt to destroy his own systems to keep from disobeying his old pilot's orders.
Maybe I can talk sense into him?
Embot doesn't seem capable of sense, Rig said, gazing at the ship and, yet again, seeming to take a moment to bask in just how great it looked.
Clean, freshly painted, sleek and dangerous. The 4 destructor cavities, 2 on each wing, gaped open, and the rear booster was missing. But otherwise, it was perfect. Rig, I said softly, in awe. I seriously can't believe you let me rope you into this.
If you want to pay me back, he said, ask FM to meet me for lunch in the park someday.
Then he immediately blushed and looked down.
I mean, maybe, if the topic comes up or something. Or not.
I grinned, punching him in the arm.
So you are still Rig. I was starting to worry there.
Yeah, yeah. Let's ignore what I said and focus on the important things. The insane AI says its stealth systems are good enough to keep the DDF from noticing it. And I guess we just have to trust it on that one.
So what do you say? Want to take it up for a quick test flight?
Scud, yes.
Rig looked up.
Any ideas on how to get out, though? That gap is barely large enough for a person.
I might have an idea, I said, but it's probably going to be a tad messy. And dangerous.
Rig sighed. I suppose I shouldn't have expected otherwise.
About an hour later, I climbed into Embot's cockpit, nearly trembling with excitement. I placed Doomslug in the seat behind me, then did up my buckles. My little cavern looked bare now that we'd packed up my kitchen and all of Rig's equipment. We'd stowed what we could in the cockpit and had hauled the rest out through the crack using my light line. Rig waited a safe distance away. I got to do the fun part myself. And, like most fun parts, it would involve breaking things.
You ready? I said to Embot.
I have basically 2 states, he said. Ready and powered down.
Needs work as a catchphrase, I said, but the sentiment is pretty cool.
I rested my hands on the control sphere and the throttle, breathing in and out.
"Just so you know," M-Bot said, "I could hear what you two were saying earlier, when you were whispering. The part where Raj said I was insane."
I realized you could probably...